Intercom back up there?
Blog Talk Radio.
CSKT, right?
Well, you dadgum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, you dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Uh-huh. Well, you dadgum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Where you get dumb, get dumb, get dumb government. Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Uh-huh.
Welcome to Handling the Truth with the Rebel Madman and Tenacity. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host, Mike Getty. Michael, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, I'm coming right along, Terry. How about you, bud?
Well, I'm a little worn out. Been running all day long and looking forward to this show, though. I'm just going to kind of sit back and relax and absorb what you're about ready to share with us. Probably ought to start this thing out right. I think we could use all the help we can get. Let's open it with a prayer and try to get some divine intervention here. I think we need it. Ah, gracious Father, I just thank you for opening our eyes to truth around us. I thank you so much for my good friend Mike Getty and all the things that he shares and the truth that we bring forward here on Handling the Truth. And Father, I just pray that what we say and do here is in your desire, that we can catch the wave that you're creating, and we're bringing a message forward that pleases you. And we just ask you to fill us with your spirit and be with our listeners tonight and get us through this show, this presentation, that we put forth a clear message, Father. We just pray for our communities, our neighbors, and these United States, because we're certainly under attack, and we know that the enemy that's attacking us is your enemy as well. We just pray that you would shut them down, that you would stop their efforts to destroy this republic. Father, we're thankful especially that you give us an audience with you and that you give us a way back to be reconciled with you through your son, Yahshua. It's in his name that we pray, our Savior, our King, Yahshua HaMashiach. Amen. Well, Mike.
Amen.
You've been telling me about this letter from Thomas Jefferson to Washington, and of course, like you did last week, you might want to back up and start someplace else. But I'm really excited about hearing exactly the issues that Thomas Jefferson was having.
Well, Terry, actually, I'm going to read excerpts from two letters, and they're about 4 months apart in 1792. And to give the folks a little background, it's the first session or the first term of the George Washington administration, and which started in 1789. And Washington initially said that he was not going to run for re-election. And, of course, Jefferson alludes to that in his letter. But, of course, Jefferson was Secretary of State. Alexander Hamilton was Secretary of the Treasury, and Washington, of course, was President, and John Jay was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So the only person who was not a staunch Federalist in that first administration was Thomas Jefferson. So right off, they begin to have a real issue with between Thomas Jefferson and Hamilton. And it began to bother Jefferson to the point of the way it was being handled that he felt just absolutely obligated to take his issues with Hamilton to George Washington. Now, you know, with all of the studies that I did, you know, all the way through my educational process, you know, these things were never discussed. And I think that we have been deprived in the education through academia of not knowing about these conflicts that were taking place in that first administration. I mean, after high school and college, I thought, you know, everything was just hunky-dory. I knew that Jefferson eventually left the administration after Washington's first term, but I wasn't sure why. So I'm going to start with the letter in May of 1792 from Jefferson to Washington and to try to lay a little bit of the groundwork. And then, of course, the later letter in September is the one that really gets into the hardcore issues. But here is the quote from the first letter, and it starts with, "It has been urged then that a public debt greater than we can possibly pay before other causes of adding new debt to it will occur has been artificially created by adding together the whole amount of the debtor and creditor sides of the accounts instead of taking only their balances, which could have been paid off in a short time. That this accumulation of debt has taken forever out of our power those easy sources of revenue, which applied to the ordinary necessities and exigencies of government, would have answered them habitually and covered us from habitual murmurings against taxes and tax gatherers, reserving extraordinary calls for those extraordinary occasions which would animate the people to meet them." So, to stop here with the direct quote, what has happened here is Jefferson has just accused, he hasn't mentioned him yet, but he has just accused Hamilton of making the public debt much larger than it actually was with creative bookkeeping. And, of course, we know that Hamilton created the first U.S. bank in 1791, which Jefferson very vociferously opposed because he said it wasn't constitutional. But unfortunately, Washington went ahead and allowed Hamilton to create the first Bank of the United States. And so then we see the manipulation that had begun already, and we don't know who the stockholders were in this bank because they were never listed anywhere. We don't know if those stockholders were inside the United States, or we don't know if the stockholders for this bank was outside of the United States. We have no way of knowing. They were never recorded, just like now with the Federal Reserve. We know very little about who the officers are of the Federal Reserve, except for the ones, you know, that are in the news. But here we see that Hamilton has created, because as Jefferson mentioned, has been artificially created by adding together the whole amount of the debtor and the creditor sides of accounts. So Hamilton was taking both sides of the ledger and calling it a debt, which means that the people were having to pay interest on that debt through taxes. And it was concerning Jefferson because he said that we're causing discord among the people because they don't like these taxes and the tax gatherers. And then if we need something for extraordinary reasons, we're already hamstrung because we're already taxing them to the point that they don't like it. And now, having said that, I'll go back to the letter itself. And Jefferson says that though the calls for money have been no greater than we must generally expect for the same or equivalent exigencies, yet we are already obliged to strain the impost till it produces clamor and will produce evasion and war on our own citizens to collect it and even to resort to an excise law of odious character with the people, partial in its operation, unproductive unless enforced by arbitrary and vexatious means, and committing the authority of the government in parts where resistance is most probable and coercion least practicable. They cite propositions in Congress and suspect other projects on foot still to increase the massive debt. They say that by borrowing at two-thirds of the interest, we might have paid off the principal in two-thirds of the time, but that from this we are precluded by its being made irredeemable, but in small portions and long terms. Here again, creative bookkeeping by Hamilton to increase the national debt so as to increase the amount of interest that is being paid to these international bankers. Well, I say international, there's no proof of that. I take that back. Whoever the stockholders were that are getting the interest off this money, Hamilton is artificially increasing the debt through his creative bookkeeping. That this irredeemable quality was given it for the avowed purpose of inviting its transfer to foreign countries. They predict that this transfer of the principal, when completed, will occasion an exportation of $3 million of dollars annually for the interest, a drain of coin of which, as there has been no example, no calculation can be made of its consequences. That the banishment of our coin will be completed by the creation of $10 million in paper money in the form of bank bills now issuing into circulation. They think the 10 or 12% annual profit paid to the lenders of this paper medium, meaning the stockholders, are taken out of the pockets of the people who would have had without interest the coin it is banishing. That all the capital employed in paper speculation is barren and useless, producing, like that on a gaming table, no accession to itself, and is withdrawn from commerce and agriculture where it would have produced addition to the common mass, that it nourishes in our citizens habits of vice and idleness instead of industry and morality, that it has furnished effectual means of corrupting such a portion of the legislature. Now, here we get into this part, which will be elaborated in the next letter, where Jefferson is telling Washington that Hamilton is taking money and is buying members of the legislature. Wow, imagine that. You think that might happen today? So he's buying members of the legislature to get the rulings the way that Hamilton wants it so he can continue this scam that he's running on the debt with the people. And moving back to the letter, that it has a furnished effectual means of corrupting such a portion of the legislature as turns the balance between the honest voters, whichever way it is directed, meaning the voters in the legislature, that this corrupt squadron, deciding the voice of the legislature, have manifested their dispositions to get rid of the limitations imposed by the Constitution on that legislature, limitations on the faith of which the states acceded to that instrument. That's a profound statement, Terry. Jefferson is saying that, look, what the people were promised the legislature was going to do is not happening because Hamilton is buying members of the legislature to get them to vote in the way that he wants them to vote. Continuing with the letter, that the ultimate object of all of this is to prepare the way for a change from the present Republican form of government to that of a monarchy of which the English Constitution is to be the model. Contemplated in the convention is no secret because its partisans have made none of it. So he is now referring to Hamilton's pitch on the 18th of June in 1787 for a monarchy. And so now what Jefferson is alleging is that Hamilton is trying to create that monarchy that he wanted by buying enough members of legislature to get them to vote the way that he wants to. So basically what Hamilton is doing is stealing from the people what they believe they ratified in the Constitution itself. So he said to effect it then was impracticable, meaning that he couldn't get it done during the Constitutional Convention. He says, but they are still eager after their object and are predisposing everything for its ultimate attainment. So many of them have gotten into the legislature, talking about the Federalists, that aided by the corrupt squadron of paper dealers, the bankers, who are at their devotion, they make a majority in both houses of the Congress. The Republican Party, who wish to preserve the government in its present form, are fewer in number. What he basically means by the Republican Party are the anti-Federalists who made it into the first Congress. He says they are fewer even when joined by the two, three, or half a dozen, well, again, anti-Federalists, who, though they dare not avow it, are still opposed to any general centralized government. But being less so to a Republican than a monarchical one, they naturally join those whom they think pursuing the lesser evil. The lesser evil. Do we still hear that about voting?
Yep.
Of all of the mischiefs objected to the system of measures before mentioned, none is so afflicting and fatal to every honest hope as the corruption of our legislature. As it was the earliest of these measures, it became the instrument for producing the rest and will be the instrument for producing in future a king, lords and commons, or whatever else those who direct it may choose. Withdrawn such a distance from the eye of their constituents, and these so dispersed as to be inaccessible to public information, and particularly to that of the conduct of their own representatives, form the most corrupt government on earth, if the means of their corruption be not prevented. The only hope of safety hangs now on the numerous representation which is to come forward the ensuing year. What he's talking about is the new states and the new states that were being added, Kentucky, you know, the other ones that are coming on. And he's saying that the hope for recovering the legislature will be in these new representatives, which may form with the anti-Federalists to combat what Hamilton is trying to do by buying the Federalists in the legislature.
Am I mistaken, or did Jefferson just accuse Hamilton of treason?
Exactly. And see, this is what troubles me, is Jefferson has the concrete proof here, as we'll get into in the next letter. And what did Washington do with Jefferson? I mean, do with Hamilton?
I got a roofer working over my head, so if you hear this thumping behind me, that's what it is. I'm hoping my wife will get home and make him quit. what did Washington do to Hamilton? Well, obviously he didn't shut him down.
No, what eventually happened in Washington's second term is the debt became so large and the inflation was over 70% that Hamilton basically had to resign. But Washington never, even with these accusations in 1792, 3 years later, Washington had still done nothing with Hamilton. So he says that, let me get back to it now. As I said, the only hope for safety hangs now on the numerous representation which is to come forward the ensuing year. Some of the new members will probably be either in principle or interest with the present majority. So he's saying that some of them may have already been bought off. But it is expected that the great mass will form an accession to the Republican Party. They will not be able to undo all which the two preceding legislatures, and especially the first, have done. Public faith and right will oppose this, but some parts of the system may be rightfully reformed. A liberation from the rest, unremittingly pursued as fast as right will permit, and the door shut in the future against similar commitments of the nation. Should the next legislature take this course, it will draw upon them the whole monarchical and paper interest. But the latter, I think, will not go all lengths with the former, because creditors will never, of their own accord, fly off entirely from their debtors. Therefore, this is the alternative least likely to produce convulsion. But should the majority of the new members be still in the same principles with the present and show that we have nothing to expect but a continuance of the same practices, it is not easy to conjecture what would be the result, nor what means would be resorted to for correction of the evil. True wisdom would direct that they should be temperate and peaceable, but the division of sentiment and interest happens, unfortunately, to be so geographical that no mortal can say that what is most wise and temperate would prevail against what is more easy and obvious. He says, I can scarcely contemplate a more incalculable evil than the breaking of the Union into two or more parts. Yet when we review the mass which opposed the original coalescence, when we consider that it lay chiefly in the southern quarter, that the legislatures have availed themselves of no occasion of allaying it, but on the contrary, whenever northern and southern prejudices have come into the conflict, the latter have been sacrificed and the former soothed. That the owers of the debt are in the southern and the holders of it in the northern division. Wow, he's already predicting the Civil War. That the anti-federal champions are now strengthened in argument by the fulfillment of their predictions, that this has been brought about by the monarchical federalists themselves, who, having been for the new government merely as a stepping stone to a complete monarchy, have themselves adopted the very constructions of the Constitution, of which, when advocating its acceptance before the tribunal of the people, they declared it insusceptible. That the Republican Federalists, who espouse the same government for its intrinsic merits, are disarmed of their weapons, that which they denied as prophecy being now become true history. Who can be sure that these things may not proselyte the small number which was wanting to place the majority on the other side? And this is the event at which I tremble, to prevent which I consider your continuance at the head of affairs as of the least importance. The confidence of the whole Union is centered in you. Your being at the helm will be more than an answer to every argument which can be used to alarm and lead the people in any quarter into violence or secession. North and South will hang together if they have you to hang on, and if the first corrective of a numerous representation should fail in its effect, your presence will give for trying others not inconsistent with the Union and peace of the states. So what he was saying to Washington, because Washington was thinking of not running again, and Jefferson was encouraging Washington, even after he had told him about all of the things that Hamilton was doing, Jefferson felt like that the country would fly apart without Washington at its helm. And then Jefferson continues, he says, I am perfectly aware of the oppression under which your present office lays your mind, and of the ardor with which you pant for retirement to your domestic life. But there is sometimes an eminence of character on which society have such peculiar claims as to control the predilection of the individual for a particular walk of happiness, and restrain him to that alone arising from the present and future benedictions of mankind. This seems to be your condition, and the law imposed on you by Providence is forming your character and fashioning the events on which it was to operate. And it is to motives like these, and not to personal anxieties of mine or others, who have no right to call on you for sacrifice, that I appeal from your former determination and urge a revisal of it on the ground of change in the aspect of things, should an honest majority result from the new and enlarged representation. Should those acquiesce whose principles or interests they may control, your wishes for retirement would be gratified with less danger. as soon as that shall be manifest, without awaiting the completion of the second period of 4 years. One or two sessions will determine the crisis, and I cannot but hope that you can resolve to add one or two more to the many years you have already sacrificed to the good of mankind. So,
Mike,
Jefferson has laid out a corrupt system that is being run by the Secretary of the Treasury, and including the buying off of members of legislature to make sure that his agenda is followed as Secretary of Treasury. But he has asked in very polite terms for Washington to stay, because he believes that without Washington, the whole thing will fly apart and be a catastrophe. So what do you think so far, Terry?
I'm in shock. I am. And you know, it takes a lot to shock me. But I don't understand how I've lived nearly 70 years on this earth and had no knowledge of this letter until now. How in the world has something so monumental, and these accusations leveled by someone of high esteem in our history, has been quiet and hidden from the public for nearly 230 years. I'm just blown away, Mike. I heard what Thomas Jefferson said, and I'm angry that this has not been news for two centuries.
Well, that's what you get when you're dumb enough to go scratching around in the National Archives and the Library of Congress. So now I'm going to move, let me summarize the letter, and we can go into it at some point if you'd like to. But Washington writes back in August. He answers him. This letter was written in May. Washington answers Jefferson in August. And he tells him that, I am aware of the dissensions, and, and it's troubling me, basically, is what Washington was saying. He said, I want, the old Rodney King approach. Why can't we all just get along? So that is basically Washington's approach. But I would like to jump now to the end of Washington's second term, when Washington said that the worst thing that could happen was the factions or dividing of the country into political parties. Now, I always thought that was a great utterance by Washington when I first read about that, his farewell address. But by this time, Jefferson had left, and so had Hamilton. So was Washington reflecting on what had occurred, and that the debt was now, so large, and the inflation rate was going through the roof, that it was just such a catastrophe? But now, let me go back to Jefferson's letter in September and answer to the letter from Washington in August. And this is where it gets really good. Jefferson says, and I quote, I now take the liberty of proceeding to that part of your letter wherein you notice the internal dissensions which have taken place within our government and their disagreeable effect on its movements. That such dissensions have taken place is certain, and even among those who are nearest to you in the administration, we know who he's talking about there, to no one have they given deeper concern than myself, to no one equal mortification at being myself a part of these dissensions. Though I take to myself no more than my share of the general observations of your letter, yet I am so desirous ever that you should know the whole truth and believe no more than the truth, that I am glad to seize every occasion of developing to you whatever I do or think relative to the government, and shall therefore ask permission to be more lengthy now than the occasion particularly calls for or would otherwise perhaps justify. When I embarked in the government, it was with a determination to intermeddle not at all with the legislature and as little as possible with any of my co-departments. The first and only instance of variance from the former part of my resolution, I was duped into by the Secretary of the Treasury and made a tool for forwarding his schemes, not then sufficiently understood by me. And of all the errors of my political life, this has occasioned me the greatest regret. Ever been my purpose to explain this to you when, from being actors on the scene, we shall have become uninterested spectators only. The second part of my resolution has been religiously observed with the War Department, and as to that of the Treasury, has never been farther swerved from than by the mere enunciation of my sentiments in conversation, and chiefly among those who, expressing the same sentiments, drew mine from me. If it has been supposed that I have ever intrigued among the members of the legislature to defeat the plans of the Secretary of the Treasury, it is contrary to all truth. As I never had the desire to influence the members, so neither had I any other means than my friendships, which I valued too highly to risk by usurpations on their freedom of judgment and the conscientious pursuit of their own sense of duty. That I have utterly, in my private conversations, disapproved of the system of the Secretary of the Treasury, I acknowledge and avow. And this was not merely a speculative difference. His system flowed from principles adverse to liberty and was calculated to undermine and demolish the Republic by creating an influence of his department over the members of our legislature. I saw this influence actually produced and its first fruits to the establishment of the great outlines of his project by the votes of every person who, having swallowed his bait, were laying themselves out to profit personally by his plans, and that had these persons withdrawn, as those interested in the question ever should, the vote of the disinterested majority was clearly the reverse of what they made it. There were no longer the votes then of the representatives of the people, but of the deserters from the rights and interests of the people. And it was impossible to consider their decisions, which had nothing in view but to enrich themselves, as the measures of the fair majority, which ought always to be respected. If what was actually doing begat uneasiness in those who wished for virtuous government, that was further proposed was not less threatening to the friends of the Constitution. For in a report on the subject of manufactures, still to be acted on, it was expressly assumed that the general government has the right to express, has a right to exercise all powers which be for the general welfare. That is to say, all the legitimate powers of government, since no government has a legitimate right to do what is not for the welfare of the governed. There was indeed a sham limitation of the universality of this power to cases where money is to be employed. But about what is it that money cannot be employed? Thus, the object of these plans taken together is to draw all of the powers of the government into the hands of the general legislature, to establish means for corrupting a sufficient core in that legislature to divide the honest votes and preponderate by their own the scale which suited, and to have that core under the command of the Secretary of the Treasury for the purpose of subverting step by step the principles of our Constitution, which he has so often declared to be a thing of nothing, which must be changed. Such views might have justified something more than mere expressions of dissent, beyond which, nevertheless, I never went. So here Jefferson laid out how the Secretary of Treasury is running the government, running the legislature with bribes, and he is making where the legislature is voting to make themselves more and more money. You think that might be happening today, Terry?
Well, it's been going on for all of my life, and it's only escalated. And when the Bushes came into control, and subsequently the Clintons, it escalated to a whole new height, literally globally. You're breaking up, Mike.
I can't help that, my friend.
You're better now.
Can you hear me now? Okay.
Yeah, a lot better than a while ago.
So here is, he's laid it out that this form of corruption, and I thought it ironic that the very first person to start complaining about the Articles of Confederation all the way back in 1781 and 82, right after they were ratified, was Alexander Hamilton. So then he worked with Madison and others to get a new constitution in 1787, and then within 5 years, he is complaining that this constitution is worthless. What's it going to take to satisfy Hamilton? Every part of government seems to be something that limits his empowering and enriching himself. So now to continue with the letter, has abstinence from the department committed to me been equally observed by him? To say nothing of the other interferences equally known in the case of the two nations with which we have the most intimate connections, France and England. My system was to give some satisfactory distinctions to the former of little cost to us in return for the solid advantages yielded us by them, and to have met the English with some restrictions which might induce them to abate their severities against our commerce. So here Jefferson is saying, I haven't interfered with Hamilton at all in his office, but he has, through his influence, been trying to influence mine, and he actually openly criticized Jefferson in the media of the day. And so Jefferson continues. He says, I have always supposed this coincided with your sentiments. Secretary of the Treasury, by his cabals with members of the legislature and by high-toned declamation of other occasions, has forced down his own system, which was exactly the reverse. He undertook of his own authority the conferences with the ministers of these two nations and was, on every consultation, provided with some report of a conversation with the one or the other of them adapted to his views. These views thus made to prevail, their execution fell, of course, to me. And I can safely appeal to you, who have seen all of my letters and proceedings, whether I have not carried them into execution as sincerely as if they had been my own, though I ever considered them as inconsistent with the honor and interest of our country. That they have been inconsistent with our interest is but too fatally proved by the stab to our navigation given by the French. So that if the question be by whose fault is it that Colonel Hamilton and myself have not drawn together, the answer will depend on that to two other questions. Whose principles of administration best justified by their purity, conscientious adherence, and which of us has, notwithstanding, stepped farthest into the control of the department of the other? So what is apparent to me from these letters, and I'm also taking into consideration Washington's return letters, which we can read at some point, but what I'm seeing here is the fact that basically
you're fading. You're fading. I can hardly hear you now.
Well, I don't know what.
You're popping in and out.
Must be the signal.
Mike, what's becoming apparent to me, and hopefully some of what you have discovered now in the correspondence between Hamilton and Morris will illustrate this, but my suspicions are now heavily raised regarding what happened between Annapolis in 1786 and Philadelphia in 1787. How many of those in attendance at Philadelphia in 1787 were in fact bribed and under this kind of criminal influence going into that convention?
And it's one that deserves an answer. And of course, you know, it's going to be really hard to give to the majority of the people out there, because the people out there in this country have been taught that this Constitution was divinely inspired, and they do not feel like they should question anything about it. But these letters prove absolutely otherwise, and I make the contention, it is my position after reading all of these letters, that basically Hamilton was running the country, and Jefferson was complaining about it to Washington. That's my take on it. Do you see something different?
I had no idea Washington was so impotent as a president. Obviously, whether by choice or not by choice, he didn't get the job done, and he let it happen for years.
Well,
I just don't.
Go ahead.
You got to wonder what kind of influence Hamilton had over Washington.
That has been a big question, which I have not been able to answer in any of my readings or studies. I have not, but I think back to that great University of Alabama historian, Forrest McDonald, and his description, which I felt was, you know, when I first read it, I was kind of shocked. But his description of Washington, when he said that the latter part of Washington's life, including his presidency, he was basically doing nothing but playing a part. And he didn't elaborate on that, but it has always made me wonder, now that I'm looking at these other things, was knowing that Forrest McDonald went deeper into the National Archives than any historian in modern-day times. Forrest McDonald passed away not too long ago. But it makes me wonder exactly what else he saw that would lead him to the point of saying publicly in one of his books that Washington was basically just playing a role, playing a part. That is troubling on several levels. I'll go back to the letter here now, and he says, "To this justification of opinions expressed in the way of conversation against the views of Colonel Hamilton, I beg leave to add some notice of his late charges against me in Fino's Gazette," which was a newspaper, as I alluded to before. He was complaining about Jefferson in the media of the day. "For neither the style, matter, nor venom of the pieces alluded to can leave a doubt of their author. Spelling my name and character at full length to the public, while he conceals his own under the signature of, quote, an American, unquote, he charges me with having written letters from Europe to my friends to oppose the present Constitution while depending with a desire of not paying the public debt, with setting up a paper to decry and slander the government. The first charge is most false. No man in the U.S., I suppose, approved of every title in the Constitution. No one, I believe, approved more of it than I did. And more of it was certainly disapproved by my accuser than by me, parts mostly vitally Republican. Of this, the few letters I wrote on the subject, not more than half a dozen, I believe, will be a proof. And for my own satisfaction and justification, I must tax you with the reading of them when I return to where they are. You will there see that my objection to the Constitution was that it wanted a Bill of Rights, securing freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom from standing armies, freedom from freedom of trial by jury, and constant habeas corpus act. Colonel Hamilton's was that it wanted what the Constitution wanted was a king and a House of Lords. The sense of America has approved my objection and added the Bill of Rights, and not a king and a House of Lords. I also thought a longer term of service, insusceptible of renewal, would have made a president more independent. My country has thought otherwise, and I have acquiesced implicitly. He wished the general government should have power to make laws binding the states in all cases whatsoever. Our country has thought otherwise. But has Hamilton acquiesced? Notwithstanding my wish for a Bill of Rights, my letter strongly urged the adoption of the Constitution by 9 states at least to secure the good it contained. I at first thought that the best method of securing the Bill of Rights would be for 4 states to hold off till such a bill should be agreed to. But the moment I saw Mr. Hancock's proposition to pass the Constitution as it stood and give perpetual instructions to the representatives of every state to insist on a Bill of Rights, I acknowledged the superiority of his plan and advocated for universal adoption. The second charge is equally untrue. My whole correspondence while in France and every word, letter, and act on the subject since my return prove that no man is more ardently intent to see the public debt soon and sacredly paid off than I am. This exactly marks the difference between Colonel Hamilton's views and mine, that I would wish the debt paid tomorrow. He wishes it never to be paid, but always to be a thing wherewith to corrupt and manage the legislature. I have never inquired what number of sons, relations, and friends of senators, representatives, printers, or other useful partisans Colonel Hamilton has provided for among the 100 clerks of his department, the 1,000 excisemen, custom house officers, loan officers, etc., 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 appointed by him or at his nod, and spread over the Union, nor could ever have imagined that a man who has the shuffling of millions backwards and forwards from paper into money and money into paper, from Europe to America and America to Europe, the dealing out of treasury secrets among his friends in what time and measure he pleases, and who never slips an occasion of making friends with his means, that such and one, and I say, would have brought forward a charge against me for having appointed the poet Freneau translating clerk to my office with a salary of $250 a year. That fact stands thus. While the government was at New York, I was applied to on behalf of Freneau to know if there was any place within my department to which he could be appointed. I answered there were but 4 clerkships, all of which I found full, and continued without any change. When we moved to Philadelphia, Mr. Cantard, the translating clerk, did not choose to move with us. His office then became vacant. I was again applied to there for Freneau and had no hesitation to promise the clerkship for him. I cannot recollect whether it was at the same time or afterwards that I was told he had a thought of setting up a newspaper there. But whether then or afterwards, I considered it as a circumstance of some value, as it might enable me to do what I had long wished to have done, that is to have the material parts of the Leyden Gazette brought under your eye and that of the public in order to possess yourself and them of a juster view of the affairs of Europe than could be obtained from any other public source. This I had ineffectually attempted through the press of Mr. Freneau, while in New York, selecting and translating passages myself at first. And I would like to interject here, a lot of people are unaware that Thomas Jefferson was fluent in 4 different languages. And he was translating passages from French into English for the papers in America at that time. Now back to his words. Then having it done by Mr. Pintard, the translator, way too slowly into Mr. Freneau's newspapers. Mr. Bach essayed it for me in Philadelphia, but this being a daily paper did not circulate sufficiently in the other states. He even tried, at my request, the plan of a weekly paper of recapitulation from his daily paper in hopes that that might go into other states. But in this, too, we failed. For no, as translating clerk and the printer of a periodical through the states, uniting in the persons of Pintard and Pinot, revived my hopes that the one thing could at length be effected. On the establishment of his paper, therefore, I furnished him with the laden gazettes with an expression of my wish that he could always translate and publish the material and the intelligence they contained. So what he was doing was explaining to Washington, because Hamilton had accused him publicly of setting up his own newspaper to criticize Hamilton, in effect. So what he was doing was answering to Washington that he was giving him the circumstances, and to people who, not being totally understanding of this, it could issue into, you know, be kind of dull to think about. So any thoughts, Terry?
Wow, just more of what I said a while ago. I'm just blown away, Mike. I'm absolutely blown away at the way Hamilton has been deified in history. And when people, when they come out with these screenplays and everything else that regarding him, and glorifying this criminal, this lying, treasonous criminal, I mean, and what he's cost us throughout the, you know, the whole time of the United States is just beyond, it's beyond all belief that they've deified this guy and glorified him the way they have. It just, it really, really sticks in my craw at this point. And I'm for the rest of my life now, whenever anybody tries to make this guy look like a good guy, I'm going to have to stand up and shout it from the rooftops that they're lying. That this guy was as bad as any of the players today, and worse. Look at the precedents that he set.
And that is, you know, and I think it was George Will who said that, you know, in America, we quote Thomas Jefferson, but we live in Hamilton's country. And so that, I think, is so true. And for the people who are listening in, if you would like a really good book on Hamilton himself and what his fingerprints that he left and footprints that he left on the government that we're living under today, even with all this chaos and all the debt that we are looking at, I would highly recommend Hamilton Curse by Professor Thomas DiLorenzo. That he does, Professor DiLorenzo does an excellent job in taking Hamilton's curse right down through the periods of history right until today. So
I've just gotten started a little bit reading that. I'm looking forward to having the time to get through it. I've got it on Kindle.
And Terry, in your time, and I know you don't have much free time anymore, but just do a little background search, and I will send it to you. I don't have it in front of me right now, but do a little background search on who provided all of the money to finance this play on Hamilton. You know, when you look
you
at things
that?
And find out who put, yes, I have. And I will send you that information. That is a subject that's a subject I would like to get into at another time. And
okay.
Then I will move. Let me move forward with this now. I don't want to break stride with where we're going with this letter. I think this letter is so important. So going back to the letter, I'm skipping some parts where he talks about the interchange between the newspapers. But then Jefferson says, no government ought to be without censors. And where the press is free, no one ever will. If virtuous, it need not fear the fair operation of attack and defense. Nature has given to man no other means of sifting out the truth, either in religion, law, or politics. I think it is as honorable to the government neither to know nor notice its sycophants or censors as it would be undignified and criminal to pamper the former and persecute the latter. So much for the past. A word now of the future. When I came into this office, it was with a resolution to retire from it as soon as I could with any decency. It pretty early appeared to me that the proper amount would be the first of those epochs at which the Constitution seems to have contemplated a periodical change or renewal of the public servants. So he basically very elaborately said elections. In this, I was confirmed by your resolution respecting the same period, from which, however, I am happy and hoping you have departed. I look to that period with the longing of a wave-worn mariner who has at length the land in view and shall count the days and hours which will still lie between me and it. If the meanwhile my main object will be to wind up the business of my office, avoiding as much as possible all new enterprise, with the affairs of the legislature as I never did intermeddle, so I certainly shall not begin to do so now. I am more desirous to predispose everything for the repose to which I am withdrawing than expose it to be disturbed by newspaper contests. If these, however, cannot be avoided altogether, yet a regard for your quiet will be a sufficient motive for deferring it till I become merely a private citizen, when the propriety or impropriety of what I may say or do may fall on myself alone. I may then, to avoid the charge of misapplying that time, which now belonging to those who employ me, should be wholly devoted to their service. If my own justification or the interest of the Republic shall require it, I reserve to myself the right of then appealing to my country, subscribing my name to whatever I write, and using with freedom the truth, the facts, and the names necessary to place the cause in its just form before that tribunal. To a thorough disregard of the honors and emoluments of office, I join as great a value for the esteem of my countrymen and conscious of having merited it by an integrity which cannot be reproached, and by an enthusiastic devotion to their rights and liberty. I will not suffer my retirement to be clouded by the slanders of a man whose history, from the moment at which history can stoop to notice him, is a tissue of machinations against the liberty of the country, which has not only received and given him bread, but heaped its honors on his head. Still, however, I repeat the hope that it will not be necessary to make such an appeal. Though little known to the people of America, I believe that as far as I am known, it is not as an enemy to the Republic, nor an intriguer against it, nor a waster of its revenue, nor a prostitutor of it to the purposes of corruption, as the American represents me. And I confide, now again, Hamilton was writing under the name The American, so that's who he's referring to. And he says, and I confide that yourself are satisfied that, as to dissensions in the newspapers, not a syllable of them has ever proceeded from me, and that no cabals or intrigues of mine have produced those in the legislature. And I hope I may promise both to you and myself that none will receive alignment from me during the short space I have to remain in office, which will find ample employment in closing the present business of the department. Observing that letters written at Mount Vernon on the Monday and arriving at Richmond on the Wednesday reach me on Saturday, I have now the honor to mention that the 22nd instant will be the last of our post days that I shall be here, and consequently that no letter from you after the 17th will find me here. Soon after that, I shall have the honor of receiving at Mount Vernon your orders for Philadelphia, and of there also delivering you the little matter which occurs to me as proper for opening of Congress, exclusive of what has been recommended in former speeches and not yet acted on. In the meantime, and ever, I am with great and sincere affection and respect, dear sir, your most obedient and most humble servant, Thomas Jefferson. So,
this had to be tearing his guts apart.
Oh, I'm sure it was. And this is the one part I would like to read again because I just love Jefferson's way with words. And again, I'm repeating, I will not suffer my retirement clouded by the slanders of a man whose history, from the moment at which history can stoop to notice him, is a tissue of machinations against the liberty of the country, which has not only received and given him bread, but heaped its honors on his head. That is very a polite way of exposing Hamilton for the, pardon the phraseology, the bastard that he was.
Would you like to see the unedited first draft of that letter?
Oh, my. And this is something, I don't know if we've ever mentioned it on this show, but a thorough research of Jefferson and the thousands of letters that he wrote, we find two basically polar opposites in our founding history. And that was Patrick Henry, who you can hardly find anything that Patrick Henry wrote, who actually put, quill to paper or quill to parchment, however you want to say it, and actually produced writings. There's very few and far between with Patrick Henry, but his speeches and his oratory are just, everywhere. If you look, they don't teach many of them because it's hard to get people who believe that the Constitution was divinely inspired to understand that the man that the founders themselves referred to as the most devout Christian among them, it's hard to explain how this man fought harder against the ratification of the Constitution than any man in that era. That old question of if it was divinely inspired, somebody, obviously Patrick Henry didn't get the memo. So when you look at all of the oratory of Patrick Henry, and it's beautiful. I love reading all of his, especially the Virginia ratification debates, and to read that. And I don't believe there's a sentence anywhere in American history more powerful than "Give me liberty or give me death." So we look at that, but then when you look at opposing him in this manner, is to look at Jefferson, who actually had a speech impediment. And he had somewhat of a lisp, and he was self-conscious about public speaking. And so when you look through to find Thomas Jefferson's speeches, they are not that easy to find. You look at his inauguration speeches, but there's very few others, but no one possibly in the history of this country made more notes or wrote more letters than did Thomas Jefferson. I mean, between Jefferson and James Monroe, there's over 300 letters written in code because they knew that someone was actually looking at their letters in the postal system. So they devised a code that they used. So it's fun to look at those because the code has been revealed over the years, and you can go back. And James Monroe was a true disciple of Thomas Jefferson. He believed that Jefferson had the keys and had the answers, and they were very close. So there's very much difference, but to read all of these things which Jefferson put together is astounding to me, all of these letters. And his writing is so eloquent, and I realize it would be a real problem for most people with a public school system education to understand them. But Jefferson's letters are just, I would recommend them to anyone who really wants to get an inside view of what happened in this country.
Mike, I understood that there were 3,000 of Jefferson's letters on archive at the University of Virginia, and you read all of those. Was this letter not a part of those?
Yes, it was. But the thing of it is, Terry, and I've tried to explain this to people, is that you can read a letter where your level of knowledge and understanding is at one level, and you can go back and read that letter 10, 12, 15 years later, and with the knowledge that you have accumulated in the meantime, it makes an entirely different, it means something entirely different. And yes, I read through these letters, you know, in the archives, but there was a time, I think, when you read something, and for myself, I read things that I have gone back and reread, and it's like, holy cow, how did you miss this, dummy? So, you know, if that is a reason or an explanation, that's the best I got.
Well, I have that experience with Scripture on an ongoing basis. I mean, it never stops. I totally understand what you're saying.
I agree with that as well. It's, I think, happenstances, circumstances, things happen, or an increase of knowledge from another point. And that is the reason that I think, and I give him the credit, to an old college professor. And he said, I remember him telling me, the wonderful thing, or the thing to be cursed about history, is if when you really get into it, is that every time you find an answer, you find five more questions. So, and I found that to be true. It's that, you know, and I remember several years back, and I repeated it to some friends the other day. The one thing I am sure of is I will never live long enough to know all I want to know about history.
Well, that thirst has been growing in me for the last, well, I'd say probably almost 20 years now. I really didn't have a thirst for it prior to 9/11, but when Obama got into office, the thirst that had been growing since 9/11 just took a leap. And now I share your desire.
Well, I think one of the things that woke me up too, and really sent me on this path many years ago, was reading Lysander Spooner. And Spooner was, to me, is one of the most overlooked people in our history. And Spooner basically, and I'm paraphrasing this, Spooner says our Constitution that was written in 1787 is either the reason for all of the maladies that we're looking at today. Of course, he said this over 100 years ago, about 150 years ago, he made the same statement, but today it still makes just as much sense. Our Constitution is either responsible for all of the maladies that we see in society, or it's been powerless to prevent them. And so that word from Spooner was, I think, probably propelled me into a deeper study of the Constitution when I read Spooner's words. So, you know, as we look at this, and then I know that you and I discussed it. I'm not sure if we've discussed it on this program or not. Maybe we have, or maybe it was another program we were on, Terry, where we took the letter eventually after these letters from Jefferson. George Washington wrote Hamilton a long letter, and he asked him 22 questions, and he asked Hamilton to explain the complaints that he had been hearing. And those questions are riveting. We do know from those from that letter that Washington did address this issue with Hamilton, and Hamilton initially wrote back to Washington and said, you know, Mr. President, I'm so busy, I really don't have time to respond to that now, which to me was very telling, because who is a member of the cabinet tells the president they don't have time to do what the president wanted? That to me was most telling. But then when Hamilton did answer, he answered every point. But like the typical lawyer, you read one of his answers to what Washington asked him, a question. You read the answer, and you read maybe 300, 400, 500 words, and when you finish reading those words, you have no idea what he said. No one could answer questions in a circle better than the wonderful attorney Alexander Hamilton.
Yep. He was definitely a lawyer.
Absolutely. So I don't know how much time we got left, Terry. Where do you want to go from here?
We got about, 15 minutes or so. We covered a lot of territory in this time, and I'm so tempted. I'm really looking forward to getting into those letters between Hamilton and Robert Morris. That's going to be exciting. Obviously, we don't have enough time probably right now to get into it, but can you maybe just tease us a little bit with what you've run into?
Well, I found 132 letters from Alexander Hamilton to Robert Morris in the year 1782. Now, the war is still going on, and Hamilton is an artillery officer. And my first question when I looked at in the hell did Hamilton find, and some of these letters are super lengthy. How in the hell did Hamilton, serving in the Army as an artillery officer, find the time in 1 year to write one person 132 letters?
Doesn't make any sense.
I mean, that's two or three a week. And so, and then I think at least I'm not even halfway through those letters that I found, but they're most interesting in the fact, especially when we take into effect that Robert Morris was made the financier of the Revolutionary War. And one of the first things that Robert Morris does is establish a bank. And again, we go right back to the same thing. It's called the Bank of North America. And so then he sets up right off the bat fractional reserve banking. Well, and then they loan out a whole lot more money. Then they start loaning money to the government out of this bank. And again, as in all other, we know not who the shareholders are in this bank. But we do know that the first money that Robert Morris got was $400,000 basically from France in hard gold. And what he did then was he loaned out much more than that $400,000, but his first loans were not made to the government for the war effort. The first loans that Robert Morris made was to his cronies and his friends, and he loaned them enough money to buy shares in the bank. Well, you know, that's really neat, Terry. I mean, I'm going to start a company, and I'm going to start my own bank, and I'm going to send you enough money to where you can buy shares in my bank. That's just a little weird the way that it starts, but that was, again, was called the Bank of North America. Well, and I had known this, and I had studied that and found that on many occasions, but then I found out in a letter from Alexander Hamilton to Robert Morris very early on, congratulating him on being selected as the financier of the Revolutionary War, Hamilton then in great, great detail explains to him how to start a bank. So here's an artillery officer out there allegedly fighting with Washington, the British, in some major battles at that time. But he has time to sit down and write just a very extensive letter to Robert Morris on how to start a bank. That, to me, Terry, is very suspicious. And some of the
it's beyond suspicious. It makes no sense at all.
Well, and then when he starts talking about, when he mentions the foreign influences, that is really the part that really, you know, what foreign influences are contacting Alexander Hamilton while he is a soldier in the Revolutionary Army, telling him and supplying him with ideas and even financing to help start a bank. I mean, this story gets deeper and deeper and deeper all the time, and it is most intriguing. And, you know, I'm just looking forward. I try to read one of these letters every day. Some of them are shorter. The first one was just the one where he tells him extensively, goes through about 12 or 14 steps on how to form, how to start this bank. And the steps he needs to take is most elaborate. So that I found, you know, pardon me, I found quite. And so it tells me that there were foreign influences affecting Hamilton at the time, and Hamilton mentioned France. Well, who was in France at that time that was heavy into finance, Terry?
Well, one of the Rothschild nephews, I believe, had been sent to France.
That is exactly correct. So he's talking, and we're talking about, you know, how did Hamilton know how to start a bank at that time? Where was that information coming from? And then again, we go back to the Constitutional Convention of 1787, and we know it's documented that Hamilton leaves five times during the Constitutional Convention to go back to New York. And then once he's there, he starts sending letters to Rufus King or Oliver Ellsworth or George Washington. So what was the purpose of that? Someone really wanted
to do a play.
So if someone really wanted to do a play or a movie to produce all of these things as, you know, as the letters show. Yeah, you know, obviously, having read a lot of Jefferson's letters, that part that he wrote about, you know, when history stooped to recognize him, I mean, that from coming from Jefferson is about as sharp a cut as you're going to get.
Well, who was the Rothschild guy that was traveling around in the South as kind of like spying and feeding information back? That's the way they worked. And they sent the guy down into France, and it was known that there was $2 or $3 million made in the, like, the first year that that nephew was sent down into France. Now we have a little bit of perspective on kind of how that might have happened.
Well, exactly. This was happening just prior to the war between the states. When James, I'm trying to think of his middle name, Solomon James Rothschild was like in his late 20s at the time, 27, 28 years old, and he was traveling throughout the United States, north and south. He spent a lot of time in New Orleans, and then he would go up to Charleston, then he would go to New York and Philadelphia, and all of this time as he was traveling around the U.S. in 1859, 1860, he was sending letters back home to France to his uncle about the economic situation of the U.S. at that time. And, of course, you know, in some of the letters, and I've got all of those letters, at some point in time, you know, he also, you know, talked about social events and other stuff as well. How are we on time, my friend?
We got about 6-7 minutes left.
So,
what would you like to cover,
Terry? Well, I was just going to ask you, with this knowledge and understanding, how do we relate that into the catastrophe that is America today?
Well, people don't understand why things like, I mean, they have misconceptions about why you'd put something like a mandate for Obamacare into place. Those sort of things are the major purpose of putting those sort of things into place is to disrupt the financial stability of the country. In other words, it's designed to bankrupt you. And if you look at what Hamilton did, he basically bankrupted the United States. And that process has been going on. And the whole concept, the modus operandi of never paying the principal on a debt, but, just keeping it growing so that all you ever can really pay is some of the interest. It's a permanent enslavement. But they needed to wound the middle class in order to stay in control. This power game, this global world order, obviously goes back to Hamilton and before that. It certainly, you see it playing out with Wellington and Napoleon and the London markets, and then coming into the Civil War, and you just have hiccups in the middle of it, like Jackson and the greenbacks for a short time, and Jefferson for a time when he was finally got into the presidency, and then you see JFK, for example, starting to take a shot at it, but basically the hiccups don't stop it from happening. It just keeps right on going. Their plan keeps progressing, and they keep holding on to their power by keeping it's really a subversive process that's been going on mm-hmm. throughout our history, and that's exactly where we are today. That's exactly what's happening today. Everything we see, the Black Lives Matter, the Antifa, the Pelosi's and the Schumer's and everything that George Soros is funding is designed to keep our society disrupted in a subversive manner. I mean, it's the same modus operandi over and over and over again. But people, they come out with this philanthropic kind of image to try to look like they're doing something that's positive for the people, and it's all a deception. Because all they're really doing is continuing to keep us bankrupt. That's exactly what they do.
I read something, and I'm going to jump the rails here and go off in a different direction. But I read something today that Dr. Fauci says that even after we have the injection, after we have the vaccine, that we're still going to have to wear masks and social distance. And I wonder how absolutely gullible the American public is, because if you tell people that after you have this magic vaccine, that they're still going to have to wear masks and still going to have to social distance, you are basically telling them this vaccine doesn't work.
Of course not.
So, I mean,
that's like a duh.
is the American public really that stupid? Maybe
a good third of them are really that stupid, and a good third of them are just what's the right word? Mentally lazy applies, but that's not the word I'm looking for. I'm looking for complacent. A good third of them are complacent. And then you got the other third, and some of them just don't have the courage to really take action on the pain they're already suffering. But I'd say a good third of them are that stupid.
Well, another question, Terry. What do you have most profound to say about the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
Well, she was a witch. She was evil, certainly a Lucifer worshiper. I have nothing good to say about her other than that I agree with Donald Trump's comment that she led an amazing life. I'm here. Are you not hearing me? Are you hearing me, Mike? I'm hearing you. I'm talking. But she did lead an amazing life, thanks to some criminally insane people who put her in a position of power. Because again, it was just a part of not just financially bankrupting America, but morally bankrupting America. That's her legacy, is morally bankrupting America.
Well, let's not forget that she was nominated by Bill Clinton, but Robert Dole said that she would be the greatest Chief Justice in the history of the country. I mean, not Chief Justice, Associate Justice, I'm sorry.
Well, either he was a moron, which I wouldn't disagree with, or he was a lot more evil than we ever gave him credit for.
Well, you know that the vote to confirm her in the Senate was 96-1. So she had a lot of people fooled.
Or there was a lot of people that were paid off, just like Hamilton was paying people off back then. We know that that's only accelerated.
Well, Terry, are you telling me that people actually run for office to get in on the game?
They're actually in the game before they run for office, or they would have never been financially able to buy their way into office, which is what most of them have done.
Great point. Great point. I like that. That's exactly right. You are either a member to be vetted by either party. You are already bought and paid for, or they wouldn't allow you in the game. Opposing viewpoints, welcome.
An awful lot of backdoor meetings happen before people get elected to national office.
And boy, is that ever true. And remember,
and if those backdoor meetings don't please the deep pockets, then your career is pretty much over with.
Well, I was amazed, and I've got it somewhere, was the, what's his name in Las Vegas, Sheldon Adelson? I was
right.
Amazed.
Hey, we're out of time, my good friend.
All right, buddy, can't wait to talk to you next week. Have a super week, Terry, and don't work so hard.
I'll try not to. I'll try to be there Sunday night to hear what you're bringing forward on Sunday. So everybody tune in to the Mike show called Addicted to Your Own Destruction on Revolution Radio on Sunday night. Have a good night, brother.
I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing, hallelujah. Hallelujah.